Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is Episode CV, Spartacus the Gladiator. The Roman Empire was made mighty through the hard work of slaves, but occasionally they escaped, banded together, and caused a bit of a ruckus. The last and greatest slave rebellion was led by Spartacus, a man who has come to symbolize the oppressed and resistance against tyranny. We begin the story of his life by looking at his time as a gladiator. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
So Spartacus was a slave who'd been assigned as a gladiator, who escaped from the gladiatorial school and started a slave rebellion. He's famous for taking on the might of the Roman military machine and actually defeating them in some battles. And of course, he's been made even more famous by all of the 20th and 21st century representations of him in books, film, TV. So he's sort of become this symbol of rebellion.
And I guess what helps that even more is that he wasn't an opposing military army at all. He wasn't Hannibal leading Carthaginians across the Alps with elephants. This is an army from within.
Yeah, he represents the underdog in a society. And when he's represented now on screen, that's often what's going on there. So he's not representing another state. He doesn't have the institutions and the might of a state. He kind of has to get his own band of warriors together.
Mm. What era are we talking about here?
It started in 73 BCE.
Yeah.
And Spartacus fights the Romans for, as they say, 3 years. They count inclusively. So he is finally defeated in 71 BCE. It's the era of the late Republic, when the Republic is starting to fall apart, really, and this will lead to the rise of Augustus. That's actually quite important in looking at Spartacus, because the chance to fight against these slaves and put them down is something that someone wants to have on their CV. However, it's not going to give you as much glory as fighting a foreign enemy. When the slaves first escape and they start their rebellion, it is seen as just that, just a rebellion. So the Romans sort of quickly gather together some forces and send a praetor against Spartacus and his followers. And a praetor is a high-up official. He's a magistrate, kind of second only to the consul. He's often in charge of an army, but it's not the consul himself, and there are degrees of praetors, and they send in a praetor with not very many troops. Because they assume these are just slaves, they're just rabble, it won't take much to put them down. But in fact, Spartacus and his gladiators are a tough enemy, and they defeat those first rather scrappy armies that are sent against them. And fairly quickly, the Romans realize that this is serious, that they need to send in legions who will put down this rebellion. They start to see it as a war.
So what sources do we have available when we want to talk about Spartacus, so the ancient classic sources? And what is the issue with learning about Spartacus and using those?
Well, of course, none of the sources come from him or his followers.
That's exactly what I was getting at, yes.
They all come from Romans or Greco-Romans.
But not only about that, they're mostly about Romans as well.
Exactly. So we've got a biography, but it's not a biography of Spartacus. It's the life of Crassus, the kind of main Roman general who fought against him. It's a bit like when we look at a figure like Cleopatra and we have to look at the life of Antony to find the details.
So written by Plutarch?
So yes, we have the biography written by Plutarch, The Life of Crassus. We also have the kind of incident, the slave wars turning up in bigger histories, so as in Appian's Civil Wars. And so that's a kind of segment of that, but again, very much from the Greco-Roman point of view.
Mm.
Very short, and probably maybe second century, we have a historian called Florus, but he covers all of the wars there ever were from go to woe for the Romans.
So it's like a paragraph, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and it's also been epitomized. So it's the epitome of Florus. So we don't have very much there. And we have even more fragmentary, the Historia, the history of Sallust, which is the work of Sallust that we only have in fragments.
Mm.
So Spartacus appears there too. But really, most people will go to Plutarch and Appian for substantial sources.
So in going to Plutarch and looking at Spartacus's story, Plutarch was writing quite a bit later.
So what could he have been using that we are perhaps missing now? Would there have been Livy? There would have been Livy, wouldn't there?
Livy would have covered that period, yeah, because Plutarch's writing in the late first century CE. And of course, we don't have Livy for that period, but Livy went all the way up to basically his own lifetime in the Augustan period.
Yep.
So that would have been there, and that would have been a substantial source. And Livy himself would have probably had other sources to call on as well.
Now, there were previously tensions around slaves already, weren't there? So this is going to be the third servile war that we're running across. And we've spoken about the past two ones already, though we're in Sicily. Can you just give us a bit of a summary for the people who may have missed the episode on slavery, what the current situation is between slave and Roman tensions?
Yeah, well, there had been two servile wars in the second century BCE, very much contained within Sicily. But of course, that makes the Romans worry about the potential for this to happen again.
Mm.
And these have happened on large estates. So they've been farm workers largely, not experiencing great conditions. The difference with Spartacus is that it's on the mainland of Italy. Mm. It's not as easily contained, and therefore they see it as a much greater threat.
Yeah, and Sicily being an island, it's quite easy to contain, which can be a plus or a negative if you're a rebelling slave on Sicily.
Yeah, it's quite hard to get out of, and those rebellions didn't make it out of Sicily because of that.
So what do we know about the background of Spartacus then, say, before he became a gladiator, a slave?
Well, we've got sparse details, but for example, Appian tells us that he's a Thracian by birth. Now we would think of it as part of Greece and just north of that. In antiquity, certainly the Greeks themselves thought of Thrace as a place apart, that it's culturally a little bit separate. They often looked down on it and thought of it as a bit rough and uncivilized. He had once served as a soldier with the Romans, which is an interesting detail, and you often don't get that from modern versions of Spartacus.
Yeah.
But he'd been a prisoner and sold as a gladiator, so he might have been a runaway.
I would have thought that it'd be normal to be executed if you deserted.
Not necessarily. Certainly, if there's potential for you to be an entertainer as a gladiator, and the accounts of Spartacus that we get from Plutarch and Appian tell us that he was a strapping guy, that he was very big and strong and imposing. And the Romans are really quite pragmatic. To get rid of someone like that would seem a waste. Also, I don't know if we think of being a gladiator as potentially glamorous, but from the Roman point of view, this would be humiliating punishment, because the difference between being a soldier and being a gladiator is that being a gladiator puts you in, as the historian Sallust says when he's talking about Spartacus, from the worst category. He uses the word worst when he's talking about, you know, there are gladiators and slaves, and these are the worst and the lowest strata of Roman society. So it is a way of punishing him and also keeping him enslaved.
So what do we know about his life as a gladiator then?
We know very, very little. He's a gladiator in training in a gladiator school, which means that he would have had everything taken care of for him. He was probably reasonably well fed, because you don't want gladiators to be weak. Certainly would have been given lots of carbs, from what has been found out by testing the remains that have been found in gladiator cemeteries. And we know just from one really chance extract in the historian Florus, Florus calls him a Myrmillo. So when he's actually saying, you know, the might of Rome had been disgraced by a mere Myrmillo, which is a variety of gladiator. So gladiators came in different kinds. Some of them were more heavily armed. Some of them would just have had a net and a trident, which looks terrifying, but meant you could attack from far away. Spartacus apparently was a Myrmillo, which means that he was slightly more heavily armed, and he would have had a shield and a sword and probably a big covering over one of his arms to protect it, and quite possibly a helmet. That means that he was being trained to that particular way of fighting, and he would have been put up against somebody like a retiarius, like a net man. He's being trained to be an entertainer for the Roman masses.
So he never actually got a chance to fight as a gladiator then, did he?
No, he doesn't. And it would have been a good place to be a gladiator, if you can say a good place, because he's being trained in Capua, which had been a Roman colony for a while, and there's a big amphitheater there. So there were clearly lots of performances being put on. But what it does mean is that Spartacus, who's already been a soldier, is further being trained to fight. And this means he's in a good position to lead a rebellion. But in the life of Crassus, Plutarch gives us a lot more detail. This is Crassus chapter 8. A certain Lentulus Batiatus had a school of gladiators at Capua, this is in southern Italy, most of whom were Gauls and Thracians. Through no misconduct of theirs, but owing to the injustice of their owner, they were kept in close confinement and reserved for gladiatorial combats. 200s of these planned to make their escape, and when information was laid against them, those who got wind of it and succeeded in getting away, 78 in number, seized cleavers and spits from some kitchen and sallied out. On the road, they fell in with wagons conveying gladiators' weapons to another city. These they plundered and armed themselves. Then they took up a strong position and elected three leaders. The first of these was Spartacus, a Thracian of nomadic stock, possessed not only of great courage and strength, but also in sagacity and culture superior to his fortune. It's a bit of a snobbish touch there. And more Hellenic than Thracian.
He's trying to reappropriate him.
He's Greek, really. It is said that when he was first brought to Rome to be sold, a serpent was seen coiled about his face as he slept. And his wife, who was of the same tribe as Spartacus, a prophetess, subject to visitations of the Dionysiac frenzy, declared it as a sign of great and formidable power, which would attend him to a fortunate issue, outcome. This woman shared in his escape and was living with him.
Right, so
interesting to know more about her, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but that's the only mention that anyone gives of Spartacus's wife, and Plutarch never mentions her again. So we get a little bit of background from both the writers there, not exactly conflicting, but different details from both.
Yeah, well, we get a lot more detail in Plutarch, and the gladiatorial origin is in both of them.
Yeah.
We don't get from Plutarch that he had fought with the Romans, but that's certainly possible that he'd been employed as a mercenary.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit shady. It's a little bit opaque what we know about Spartacus's background. I guess we'd have to say Plutarch gives a lot more detail and seems quite assured about it, about having this knowledge. So it's hard to argue against it.
And this calling him more Hellenic than Thracian, what's getting at there? Is it trying to say that he's a noble hero? There's this symbol with the snake going on. So clearly he was destined to be a hero,
and
therefore he has to be more Hellenic.
Well, that serpent, it's very typical of the kind of prophecy that we see with people like Alexander or Caesar, where an animal's often involved in foretelling a great future. I guess you could see it in a number of ways. There's certainly more Hellenic than barbarian, basically. It might be an attempt to explain his sagacity, his ability to form a strategy, wield an army that can then defeat Rome, to have these tactics that are effective. But also, of course, it builds him up as a formidable opponent to the Roman army. And given the outcome, where it did take years to defeat him, then it makes sense that he actually has these powers to create an army that's hard to defeat.
And he says the gladiator school was full of Gauls and Thracians. So by setting up Spartacus this way, Spartacus is special. He's not like all the other gladiators there.
Yes, he's one of the three leaders voted in, so they see that in him, presumably.
Yeah.
It's also true, though, that there were times, we do have the very odd incidents where gladiators are seen as having at least equal skills to the Roman army and being brought in to, you know, help out with training or that kind of thing.
Yes.
So they're sort of from a different class, always considered low class, but that doesn't mean that their fighting skills weren't extremely good. We know that he got hold of some weapons with however many followers there were, the accounts differ, and that they broke out and then they took on some Roman soldiers. And they got hold of their weapons.
So the Roman soldier weapons are better than gladiatorial weapons, I take it?
They would have been, and they're also considered sort of higher standard. So when Plutarch's talking about it, he says, and this is a quote from him, that Spartacus and his men got hold of many arms of real warfare. The implication is that gladiators' weapons aren't as good. They're not for real war. And they gladly took these in exchange for their own, casting away their gladiatorial weapons as dishonorable and barbarous. It's very morally loaded language that Plutarch uses, this idea that you can identify gladiatorial weapons from those of Roman soldiers. And it's much more honourable to be a Roman soldier. So that's what they want. They want this real form of fighting, not the kind that's put on for entertainment.
I assume these Roman soldiers that they defeated wouldn't have been the cream of the crop, given that, you know, they're far out from Rome. It's not going to be a very big place that they're at.
They're in Capua, which is not a particularly big town, and also the soldiers sent against them in the first instance would have just been the ones who are available, because these people are gladiators, slaves, low and humble, and the Romans don't really regard them as a threat. So they think they're just putting down rabble. They don't get together a legion to send against them. There aren't that many of them at this stage anyway. They really underestimate them, and they continue to underestimate Spartacus and his followers all the way along. Now, if Spartacus had carried on with just 70 followers, obviously the Romans would have quite quickly sent enough troops to defeat him. But his initial successes mean that he starts to gather more and more followers until the number gets to 70,000. And at some stage during those 3 years of the war, there is one estimate that puts them at 120,000. So that implies that there is a lot of dissatisfaction, a lot of people who want to run away and join this army of slaves.
In the early days of this movement, Spartacus wasn't the leader.
Initially, there are two other leaders along with Spartacus. There's a man called Crixus, who seems to have been in charge of the slaves from Gaul and Germany, or Germania, and also a man with a Greek name, Oinomaeus. But Crixus is, according to different accounts, one account he decides to go a different path from Spartacus because he wants to take on the enemy head on. And this implies that there is a difference of opinion here, that Spartacus wants to get the people around him and escape. And if they have to fight their way out, then they fight their way out. Whereas Crixus actually wants to defeat the Roman army and potentially even take his army to Rome itself, that he has ambitions and notions of power that he wants to get to. Oinomaeus kind of falls out of the story fairly early. The other thing that we learn about Crixus is that he is subsequently defeated by a Roman army, and that Spartacus seems to take this very badly, Crixus's death, because he then has 300 of the prisoners that he has. So he's taken prisoners of Roman soldiers. He has them killed as a sacrifice to Crixus's shades.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting, the sources we have on Spartacus suggest that he's sort of trying to carry out the rituals and the traditions and the customs of the Romans as if he himself has become Roman. So that starts with the swapping the gladiators' weapons for Roman soldiers' weapons. It goes through to this idea that you need to somehow appease the shades of the dead, which you wouldn't normally do with human sacrifice, but in extreme situations you might. And it also comes through in one of our accounts tell us that he got his prisoners to put on gladiatorial shows. So he's actually turning the tables. He used to be a gladiator. Now he's the one who's actually in charge of producing, as it were. He is the producer of a gladiatorial show. And he's forced his prisoners to occupy that very humble position, the position of the gladiator. So there is this idea coming through the sources that he sort of wants to make it as a Roman, or at least put himself in that position. Which is interesting, because the other thing that the sources tell us about Spartacus, all in quite different ways, but they all point to him being a very clever person, somebody who is more civilized or a cut above what you'd expect to find normally amongst gladiators.
Plutarch refers to him as Hellenic, doesn't he?
Exactly. He's from Thrace, which is considered a slightly barbaric place, but he talks about him as being more like a Greek, more Hellenic, which suggests he's more refined or educated. And there are also suggestions that come through, for example, in Sallust. Unfortunately, we only have fragments of Sallust's histories, and it breaks off in some quite annoying places, but at least we actually have a bit on Spartacus, and he says that Spartacus tries to stop his troops from some of their outrages, so that when they come upon towns or when they might have killed Romans and they just plunder and strip them of everything, or they plunder and rape when they come across towns, the Spartacus is always trying to rein them in. He doesn't regard that behavior as moral.
Mm. But the real shame about all of this and the hard part in telling the story of Spartacus is that we don't have anything from his perspective. We don't have anything from his men's perspective or anything like that. History has been written by the victors in this circumstance, haven't they?
It has very much. And that's true of Spartacus and a lot of other characters, of course, from history. It's always written by the victors. So we don't have a lot of sources written by slaves in general, or by gladiators. If we do, it tends to be tombstones or graffiti. We don't have extensive written texts. When we get histories and biographies, they're written by the Roman elite. So it's very much from their perspective. Nevertheless, as I say, it is quite notable that they try to point out that Spartacus is in some way special.
And Plutarch's account of Spartacus, while being about Crassus, the man who defeated Spartacus, very much treat Spartacus like the good guy in the story.
I suppose so, yes. It's interesting that I'm not sure you could exactly say he's the good guy. The idea of a slave rebellion, I think, is terrifying to the Romans. And Plutarch is Greek, but, you know, he is very much Romanized. But Crassus himself comes in for a little bit of critique in this biography. And perhaps within this specific episode, there are virtues that are pointed out about Spartacus to counterpoint some of the other characters. It is hard to know Spartacus's motives, and we have about 5 or 6 accounts, and sometimes they seem to give us different rationales for what he does, as if they're trying to figure out how exactly this happened and what he's after. Is he after trying to overthrow the Roman state? None of them come out blatantly and say that. But at different times, they all imply at some point that he's just trying to get away. He would like to cross the Alps, or he would like to get over to Sicily, or he would like to get somewhere else. And then at some point, something seems to change and it looks like he wants to take on the Roman armies. He might be heading for Rome, that there's that kind of impulse of attacking the state itself.
So why does Rome build up Spartacus so much as an enemy? Is it in their interest to draw attention to the rebellion?
It is and it isn't, isn't it? It sort of builds up Crassus, I suppose, that he claims that he's defeated Spartacus, although there's also talk that Pompey had a lot to do with it. It's actually bad press for them on the whole, though, I'd say, that slaves who are the lowest of the low in their society can have this capacity. You could see it as fear-mongering, you know, the way that our gutter press always wants to stir up fear amongst the masses. There's always some crisis going on, which may or may not be reflected in reality. But I think that it's often framed as part of the crisis of the Roman Republic in the first century BCE. Things are at such a stage that even slaves could mount a rebellion, something that's really challenged the Roman Republic and the Roman state. So you might want to see it in that framework, that it's not so much good or bad, but it's a symptom of what's going on.
And the fact that it's happening at all, the Romans might as well make the most of it and build up Spartacus in particular as a formidable enemy.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for us to think back into the mind of a Roman, but there's not much evidence that the Romans see him as this fighter for liberty.
Mm.
Right? Sometimes we get that with later provincial rebellions, or not even rebellions, just people fighting the Romans as they invade. And we tend to get it in works by writers like Tacitus. But there's no real sign of it in the sources around Spartacus, that he is this heroic figure. Really, you know, this reflects on Crassus. If anything, it shows that he can put down even this terrible threat to Rome.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, as always they are appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Spartacus attracts more followers and Rome starts to take the threat seriously. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.